May it please the court. My name is Ben Cohen, attorney registration number 26511, appearing on behalf of the appellant Dan Martineau. Your honors, Colorado's credit agreement statute of frauds, which I'm going to call CASOF for short, it's a very powerful statute. It allows banks to lie to their customers and even defraud them. But the statute is not so powerful as Wells Fargo thinks that it is in this case. It does not say that a written credit agreement is whatever the bank says that the written credit agreement means. CASOF is not a rule of evidence, and it's not a rule of contract construction. What it is a filter. It's a statute of fraud, so it filters out all agreements and it leaves behind only signed writings. Fine, we will live with that. All of the oral agreements go away. We're left with the signed writings in this case, but there are more signed writings than just the bank's boilerplate guarantee form. And
signed by whom?
Signed by Mr. Martineau.
Statute requires signed by whom?
Was signed by the party to be charged, or the party against whom enforcement is sought.
Who's that in this case?
In this case, that is Martineau.
And not the bank?
I'm sorry?
Not the bank.
That's right. But Daniel Martineau was a signatory not only to the bank's boilerplate form guarantee, but he also put his name at the end of the two email exchanges that is formed.
Signed the February email?
Yes.
It was sent to him, signed by the bank.
It was sent to him with the signature of the bank officer.
He signed it, sent it back.
And then Dan Martineau said, yes, I accept. The February email was basically a term sheet for the guarantee.
There's no question about the February email satisfying, I thought, the statute of frauds. I thought the issue was the April email satisfying the statute of frauds.
And it satisfies the statute of frauds as well. It is an email exchange. Mochette emails in response to an oral phone call that he had with Martineau, which admittedly CASOF excludes, but we have an email from the bank officer, Dan Mochette, saying, I'm sorry there was confusion. Here are the terms. And then he puts the February email term sheet, appends that on his email. And then, and this is key, Dan Martineau responds with an email with his name at the bottom. So it's a signed writing in which Dan Martineau says essentially, thanks. I wasn't clear from the form document that my guarantee was for interest only. Thank you for clarifying and confirming that it's for interest only. With that understanding, I will sign your form document. And he goes ahead and signs it.
At the April 2009 exchange, though appended to your response for summary judgment, was never argued to the trial court, was it?
Yes, it was. It was mentioned in the affidavit that accompanied both Mr. Martineau's Rule 56F motion and explained, and also in the affidavit and argument on the summary judgment motion, and then.
It's in the argument on the summary judgment motion?
I believe, Your Honor, that there was at least some mention of the April 2009 email in the argument on the summary judgment motion. If not, if I'm mistaken about that, then I'm confident that it's at least discussed in Mr. Martineau's affidavit. But
discussing an affidavit doesn't necessarily mean it's brought to the attention of the trial court,
This is very true, Your Honor. That is why, after the trial court entered summary judgment erroneously, in the trial court, counsel Mr. Martineau pulled out all of the stops and filed that motion for reconsideration, which put the spotlight right on that April 2009 email and explained it.
Hey, let's go back to the February 2009 email exchange that may or may not be as controversial as the April 2009 email exchange. What about that email exchange rendered ambiguous the terms of the guarantee?
Your Honor, I don't think that there is any ambiguity. I think that it's quite clear from both the February and April emails that the guarantee is for interest only. When you read the February 2009 email.
So there's no inconsistency between the documents at all?
When they are read and construed together, according to Colorado law, which requires for guarantees that they be construed according to the intent of the parties as disclosed by the surrounding circumstances and then strictly construed in favor of the guarantor.
Is that a question of law or is that a question of fact to be presented to a jury?
Oh, no, Your Honor, that's a question of law because it's a matter of contract construction, which is always a question of law for the court, and it's something that this court reviews de novo. So when you take all three documents and you put them together and you say, all right, what was the party's agreement? What were they intending? It is abundantly clear that the intention of the parties was to, for modern notary, guaranteeing unpaid interest only. The February 2009 email is all about unpaid interest. I mean, remember what was happening here. It was a $9 million loan. Martineau's company wanted a one-year extension so they could sell the house. The deal was, we'll pay down the loan by $3 million to $6 million, and then the new value or the new credit that the bank would be extending would be 1 year's worth of interest at 6%. That amount happens to be $360,000. Now, as Wells Fargo has noted, the default rule for guarantees is that they are coextensive with the principal. The principal is still $6 million, but this guarantee is for $360,000, an odd amount.
Are there other guarantors? Were there other guarantors?
I believe so, Your Honor. There were who guaranteed the principal of the loan, but not Martineau.
I was just going to say, you know, how can we tell without knowing how many other guarantors there were as to whether or not Martineau just shared a portion of that principal?
Well, the other guarantors have their guarantees, which I believe cover principal, and they're not at issue here. Martineau was not an original guarantor. He was only becoming a guarantor pursuant to for the purposes of this one-year extension. This is when he became a guarantor, not earlier. And the guarantee terms were to, quote, add Dan Martineau's personal guarantee for $360,000. The fact that in the February email they chose the amount of $360,000 gives rise to at least a very strong inference that Martineau is guaranteeing or agreeing to guarantee the interest. And remember, on summary judgment,
but maybe he's just guaranteeing the portion of the loan that's not covered by the other guarantors who you haven't filled us in about, or nobody's filled us in about, I should say.
Well, we didn't think that was relevant, Your Honor. We believe that there's at least a strong inference, very strong, that from the February email alone, this shows that this is a guarantee for interest. And that should have been enough to foreclose summary judgment and require discovery. And then, if necessary, once we've got all the discovered the bank's loan file, for instance, then we can figure out with in even greater detail exactly what the parties were agreeing to, subject to the constraints of Kassoff that were limited to the writings.
Mitch Daly asked you, what about this email suggests, as you just said, that it's only about interest? The bullet point about the guarantee says nothing about interest.
That's right, and that's what the trial court relied on, because the trial court...
Judge Daly's question, what about the rest of this email? What in the rest of the email suggests it's only about interest? Why don't you just...
That interest is mentioned in several of the bullet points. If you look at them, at least especially if you look at them the way that we've written it, transcribed it in our brief, we highlight and underline every time the word interest is mentioned. It makes sense. The bank is extending $36,000 of additional credit. That's the additional risk that the bank is taking on. That is what the bank needs an additional guarantee for. So when Martineau agrees, his guarantee for exactly that much is added. It is a plain inference that the guarantee is for interest. And if there were any doubt about that, Your Honors, it's made clear. Doubt is removed by the April email, which is signed by Martineau, in which Martineau says, thank you, essentially, and I'm paraphrasing here, thanks for clarifying that the guarantee is for interest. Subject to that understanding, I'll sign the documents. Obviously a paraphrase. Now, Wells Fargo has, you know, said, well, nobody from the bank ever signed a response email to that. We didn't say, yes, exactly, let's do it this way. The bank was silent. Now, the bank loan officer, Dan Moschette, could have said, that's fine, or he could have said, no, that's not our agreement. And if it wasn't their agreement, then you'd figure he would have spoken up. But that's not the only way that a bank can accept a guarantee. Colorado law provides that when a bank is considering making an extension of credit subject to a guarantee, and the bank makes the extension of credit, that is an acceptance of the guarantee. Here, the bank had Dan Martineau's email saying, in effect, thanks for clarifying that my guarantees are interest only. Subject to that understanding, I'll sign your form documents. The bank then goes and extends the credit. If the bank didn't like Martineau only guaranteeing interest, then the bank should have said, no, that won't do, and demanded that the loan be paid. What Martineau's April 2009 email was a rejection of the bank's form guarantee to the extent that it was different from his intent. It's a counteroffer. That's what Restatement of Contract Section 59 expressly says. A response that includes different terms is a counteroffer. Martin was making a counteroffer that the bank accepted when it extended the additional year of credit. So when you read all of these things together, true, the form document says what it says, but it only says what it says because Martineau first said in writing, I'm only guaranteeing interest, and the bank accepted that. That is how we know, without any ambiguity at all, that this is a guarantee for interest. Your Honors, if you think that there is any question about that or any ambiguity, then the proper course is to remand this case for discovery. I want to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, so unless the court has specific questions about the Rule 56F motion, I won't address that here, except to note that it was a clear abuse of discretion. This case is controlled by the Colorado Supreme Court's decision in Miller. Martineau filed the Rule 56F motion. He responded to summary judgment with what evidence he had, and for the trial court to ignore the 56F motion, grant summary judgment, and then treat the 56F motion as having been waived is flat contrary to the controlling law of Miller. With that said, I'll reserve my remaining 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Your Honors, may it please the Court. My name is Stephen Reinerson, attorney registration number 34825, appearing on behalf of Plaintiff Appellee, Wells Fargo Bank National Association. This case is straightforward. Mr. Martineau, a sophisticated real estate developer, signed a guarantee that in black and white stated that he absolutely and unconditionally guarantees full and punctual payment of the guarantor's share of the indebtedness, where guarantor's share of the indebtedness is defined on the face of the document as being $360,000 of the principal amount of the borrower's indebtedness, where the borrower was Starwood 94 LLC.
It's purely coincidental that the guarantee is for $360,000 when the interest for 1 year is approximately $360,000.
Do I think it's coincidental?
Yeah, do you think it's just purely coincidental that those numbers seem to match when the interest figure is that amount?
The interesting question is limited to the record. It is purely coincidental.
Well, let's talk about the record, because the guarantee also talks about all related documents. And we have these February 2009 emails, which have that one clause that the court noted, but the court didn't note the other, and there's several other clauses talking about interest. Does that not at least create an ambiguity, the potential for an inconsistency between the February understanding and the form of the guarantee itself?
No, Your Honor, we would contend that it does not. As a threshold issue, there would be the question of whether or not the related documents language can even reach the February and April emails.
Would that be a question of fact?
I believe that it would be a question of law.
It's okay.
Based on the plain language of the guarantee, which defines related documents as documents that were made in connection with the indebtedness, which we would contend the indebtedness here is the agreement between the borrower and the bank, not that anything in the universe that could be loosely connected to this transaction.
Well, it's an agreement between the borrower and the bank, is it not, in the February 2009 exchange of emails?
I don't recall that it's represented as being between the bank, being between the borrower and the bank in the February emails, compared to between Mr. Martineau as a guarantor and the bank.
And that was the subject, though. The guarantee was also the subject of the 2009 emails.
Yes, the guarantee was the subject of both the February and the April emails.
So you think it, and why would it not be considered a related document? How about that?
Because I don't believe that those emails constitute documents related to the indebtedness, which is the related documents is a defined term in the guarantee. It's not abstract.
It's not related to the guarantee, which is being signed by Mr. Martineau?
It's related to the guarantee. But the guarantee is not the indebtedness. The indebtedness is the obligation of the borrower, a different entity or party.
But the indebtedness is also defined in the document, right?
Yes.
And indebtedness is defined, it's very lengthy, I'm not going to read it, but it's indebtedness under the note and related documents. I mean, the related documents terms also related to the indebtedness, right?
Yes.
So if the related documents include, it doesn't say, it says documents executed in connection with the indebtedness. In connection with can be a fairly loose term, but indebtedness is including note and related documents. So it seems if you put all these terms together, arguably, I'm not saying for sure, but as a matter of fact, it may be that the February email is part of the related documents. Right. That's a question of law? Are you saying that's a question of law, or is that a question of fact for the jury to decide?
Well, Your Honor, the court treated the February 2009 email as being incorporated into the guarantee. So whether it's, even if it's a question of fact, the inference was made in favor of the guarantor's position. And the
only, yes, but he only focused on the last bullet point. The trial judge only focused on the last bullet point. As Judge Daly pointed out, there's other bullet points there, and as counsel, there's that refer to interest.
Correct.
Oh, there's also bullet points that are referring to principle, so I'm not quite sure what to make of it. But if the whole shebang is ambiguous, isn't that a question that a jury has to decide?
I don't think that the February 2009 email is ambiguous. Simply because there are references to interest appearing elsewhere in the document, I don't think renders the absolute statement, add Dan Martineau's personal guarantee $360,000 unsecured, as being ambiguous, particularly in light of Colorado law finding that in the absence of any other express language, a guarantee is presumed to be coextensive with the entirety of the debt.
$6 million.
Yes.
Oh, really? He signs for $360,000 when there's $6 million, the entire debt. So it's coextensive? How does $360,000 become $6 million?
No, the issue is it is coextensive. Assume that a guarantee is signed that simply says, I hereby guarantee the debt of X. Then the guarantee is extensive. The issue is repairing back from, as you add more language to the scope of the guarantee, what is left. Here, the trial court treated it, and certainly would be the bank's position that it's correct, that modifications to the scope of a guarantee pair back from that general rule that it's coextensive. And thus, in the absence of express language limiting the guarantee in some manner, it has to be read with that legal presumption gap filling the remainder.
Its purpose, support set at $360,000. It's not a fraction, a particular fraction of the total indebtedness. Is it his proportionate share based on the number of guarantors?
It's not proportionate based on the number of guarantors. There are guarantors who have other guarantors who are not at issue in this litigation, whose guarantees are for varying amounts, including percentages of the debt, absolute dollar figures of the debt. I don't know, as I stand here today, that you can add those up and get to anything that equals the complete debt.
What's your theory about how they got to 360 then? I don't even really know your theory. I like to know the reason why they got to 360.
The theory would be that the bank had additional liability exposure due to the extension of the term of the loan. And thus, the bank has, I mean, that was noted as to the issue of the interest amount for approximately one additional year being equivalent to $360,000.
And that's the additional exposure, $360,000.
Yes.
And so, and the guarantee is for $360,000 because why wouldn't the 360 match the 360 in interest exposure?
Well, it can match the $360,000 in interest exposure. The issue is whether or not it was limited to $360,000 of interest. At the end of the day, you could imagine in the bank's books, it has liabilities based on projections for the added exposure for the maturity of the loan. Then it calculates out that it has an additional $360,000 of exposure for the extension of the length of the loan. Therefore, they seek a guarantee of $360,000. However, I'll note none of this is in the record. So
well, let me shift to another question then. The April 2009 emails are pretty clear. Subject to this, I will agree. Why aren't they considered part of related documents, especially subject to this, I will sign your guarantee? Seems to me the meaning of the April 2009 emails are pretty clear. Why can't we consider those?
Well, that actually ties into an interesting point that Mr. Cohen made, suggesting that the April 2009 email is a counteroffer suggesting the terms on which Mr. Martin was willing to deal. Accepting Mr. Cohen's argument there as being true, the problem is that at the end, Mr. Martineau still executes a document that in black and white is contrary to his counterproposal, as Mr. Cohen has styled it. Basic contract law would note that where you extend a counterproposal on particular terms and then accept the offer that was made to you by the other party, you've let your own counterproposal expire.
I don't think so. Not when he says, okay, I'm not sure what about this mumbo jumbo you sent me, but I'm going to sign it subject to this condition, interest only. Okay, that does not import any meaning as to what the terms of the guarantee have to do.
Well, Your Honor, I would additionally point out that there would be a question as to whether or not that provision is enforceable in light of the credit agreement statute of frauds.
And why not?
Because although that document, it's important to note the April email exchange consists of two separate documents appearing in one email chain. The April 15th email from the bank, which says, sorry for the confusion, here is the February 2009 email, and includes the add Dan Martineau's personal guarantee for $360,000. Then we have, and that is signed, we would accept for purpose of this argument, by Mr. Moskett on behalf of the bank. Mr. Martineau responds with his alleged summary of a telephone conversation with Mr. Moskett, in which he says, thanks, now I understand that it's for interest only. While that is signed by Mr. Martineau, there is nothing in the record, not in documentary, not affidavit testimony from Mr. Martineau, that sets forth that the bank ever executed any document reflecting the interest-only term.
But they did extend the loan.
They did extend the loan, subject to a guarantee that was signed stating that it's for principal, not just interest. The issue here is that, you know, where there are multiple parties to a transaction and the credit agreement, well, this is the general rule, that where there are multiple parties in a transaction that the statute of frauds applies to, and only certain parties sign the documents in those transactions, the statute of frauds is satisfied only as to the parties who signed it. Here, Mr. Martineau is attempting to bind the bank to an email that he sent. Thus, it becomes the bank that he is attempting to enforce.
Well, how about Mr. Moshef's email to Mr. Martineau that sparks the reply that says, thanks for clearing up the confusion? Remember, there is at least one theory that February 2000 email was subject to the interpretation that it was interest only. And Mr. Moshef signs it out, and Mr. Martineau sends it back, and there's no objection to the, that's right, thank you for sending that back to me, and we agree now it's on interest. So why isn't Mr. Moshef, could Mr. Moshef be considered to have signed his document agreeing to the understanding as Mr. Martineau responded?
Well, this is where the theory accepts the characterization of the February 26, 2009 email as containing terms indicating that it should be only for interest, because otherwise Mr. Moskett's signed April 15th email can't possibly confirm Mr. Martineau's signed April 16th email.
Does it inject any issue of ambiguity into the meaning of the document such that it should be tried as an issue of fact?
The bank does not believe so, Your Honor.
The bank does not. Okay, thank you.
Do you have further questions, Your Honor?
I do. Every email has a sentence that says the borrower is to sell the TDR pledged on this property, a property, to fund the bank-controlled interest reserve. That relates to interest, right?
That is true.
And that's the bullet point right before the personal, one that right before the personal. Then there's one that says use $120,000 in loan commitment availability to pay the interest. That relates to the interest, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Then there's other provisions here that relate to the principal.
Yes, Your Honor.
So how are we to know that what it says at the end, add the personal guarantee for 360, that only relates to the principal or relates to the interest, both of which are discussed in some detail?
Yes, Your Honor, it goes back to our point, you know, we cited these cases in our brief, Continental National Bank v. Dolan, 564 P2D 955, and Morris v. Schoen, 998 P2D 38, and numerous earlier Colorado decisions that are cited therein that hold about the presumptive scope of a guarantee.
Of the indebtedness.
Exactly, Your Honor.
It's not for the whole indebtedness. It's for 360. It's $3 million.
Certainly, Your Honor. I agree. It is for $360,000, not for the $6
million. And so that's not a circumstance, absent some evidence, you presume it would be coextensive with the principal. The fact that the number 360 happens to match the 360 in interest doesn't call into question that presumption?
I do not believe so, Your Honor.
Okay.
One additional point here, Your Honors, that I wanted to flag from Mr. Cohen's argument is that, in fact, there is no, and this was discussed in his argument, there is no reference in the summary judgment response brief to the April email at all. It is mentioned only in Mr. Martineau's affidavit where he refers to the April email clarifying the February 2009 contract. Remember, Mr. Martineau's entire theory presented to the trial court was that the February 2009 email was a contract.
Or as part of the related documents.
That the related documents theory becomes, it comes in, actually, I believe, in his motion for reconsideration is the first time the related documents argument is made. In his related documents argument, he references the April email exchange, but again does not argue that it's incorporated. It's only on appeal that for the first time ever, Mr. Martineau says, oh, of course, the April 2009 email must be treated as being incorporated into the guarantee and thus creating the ambiguity that he seeks to exploit. Thank you very much, Your Honors. Wells Fargo Bank requests that this court affirm the district court's judgment.
Thank you, counsel.
Your Honors, I would like to begin the rebuttal by noting something Mr. Reinerson said in the course of his argument when he was trying to think of some reason why the $360,000 figure might be in there. He said, well, you could imagine in the bank's books. Well, we would love to see the bank's books, Your Honor. But, of course, we never got the chance to see even the bank's loan file on this matter. Wells Fargo moved for summary judgment 1 week after Mr. Martineau answered. We didn't get any discovery. We didn't even get to see the bank's own loan file, which should be the repository of every single writing, all admissible under Kassoff, we think, that would illuminate everything having to do with this case. Because the court seems to be focused on ambiguity, I will address the Rule 56F issue in more detail.
I'd suggest you not. In part because opposing counsel really didn't get a chance to address the 56F in more detail as well. So I would suggest perhaps stay with the arguments that we had, unless the other judges are interested in that.
Well, the 56F issue is well-briefed and self-explanatory. In that case, I will focus on the remaining issues. Let's see.
I remand it. If we reverse for the denial on the 56F, we could remand and allow the judge to allow discovery and rebrief the whole summary judgment issue, couldn't we?
Yes, of course. You could do that. That's one option. I would submit that because the issue before the court is a purely legal issue of contract construction, you don't need to send it back to let the trial court decide. You've got enough here, more than enough here, to determine as a matter of law, especially under the law that says guarantees are construed strictly in favor of the guarantor based on all surrounding circumstances, that this is a guarantee for interest, and your reversal should therefore instruct the trial court that this is a guarantee for interest only. So that, and then maybe finally, Wells Fargo would tell Mr. Martineau how much interest is owed. Once we know that, then we'll pay it. We think it's about $40,000. We've asked Wells Fargo, please tell us the amount.
But the record indicated about, was it $88,000?
Well, it's at least $88,000 because I think the demand letter noted that the interest plus costs and fees is $88,000. We don't know what part of that $88,000 is just the interest. We've asked Wells Fargo, please tell us the interest because we admit Martineau is liable under the guarantee to pay interest. So if you tell us the amount of interest only, we'll pay it. Wells Fargo hasn't done that. Instead, Wells Fargo has been collecting on its $360,000 judgment. It's taken, you know, debtor exams and it's garnishing bank accounts. So we do need this court's assistance in getting this thing turned around. Briefly.
Stay of this judgment?
No. No, it wasn't stayed. Mr. Martineau doesn't have the money to put up a bond. And because there's no bond, it hasn't been stayed. He's collecting, and we need to get that money back or apply what Wells Fargo has collected to the amount of interest that is actually owed. So it'd be very helpful if, and instead of doing a simple remand, the court were to clarify, yes, this we can determine as a matter of law that this guarantee is for interest only, and what Martineau owes is the interest, and that any amounts that have been collected can be applied to that, but that is the only judgment that should enter in favor of Wells Fargo and against Martineau. And then maybe, finally, we would get this matter taken care of. If the court just remands, reversing the summary judgment and remanding for further proceedings, then we could be at this for a couple more years, given Wells Fargo's intransigence to even tell us how much interest is owed.
Do you want to see what's in the bank's files?
Yeah. If we need to, if we can go straight, cut straight to the chase and learn the amount of interest, that would be an even more efficient resolution. So, Your Honor, we do ask you that you reverse the summary judgment, and also that you clarify and give directions to the trial court that this guarantee is for interest only, and to proceed on that basis. Thank you, Your Honors.
Counsel, the case will stand submitted. Opinion will issue in course. I want to thank both counsel for their excellent arguments today. Thank you both very much.